Now, when I sent it to Marty, my notes consisted of pinto beans and cornbread, or biscuits and gravy, peanut butter and jelly, milk and cookies, coffee and coffee cake. Depending on the time, maybe the day, maybe what you're doing at the time, depending on the individual, there are some things that just make the perfect combination at the right time. And I tried to mix some things up in there because one of my combinations is not, it will never be, I cannot stomach peanut butter and jelly. Do not mess up my peanut butter. I can eat it by the jar, but do not mess it up. So, depends on who you are. One of those things may be a comfort food. One of those things may be the perfect combination for you. They just go together. And for some of those things, one without the other is not the same. I do not want pinto beans without cornbread. I mean, I guess if I have to eat them, I will. But the cornbread has to be there for it to be right. They even come out of your mouth together. If you go back to Genesis 1 and you begin to work your way through Scripture, there are combinations that God has revealed in the book that just go together. Sometimes they're people. It's very difficult to think of Abraham without Sarah. Sometimes it's events and the people connected to them. It's very difficult sometimes to say Noah without the ark following immediately. Belief in baptism, repentance and baptism. The one we're looking at tonight, and Marty kind of talked about it in the song service, and those songs illustrated it, is grace and faith. And we're going to look at a particular side of faith in a minute. But Ephesians 2 and verse 8, "For by grace you have been saved through faith." This combination that Paul says to the Ephesians, these people in Ephesus, these people who a lot of them have come out of idolatry into Christianity. He said there's this combination that makes it work, that brings about your salvation. And this is not of yourselves, it is the gift of God. So part one, the part that we're not going to focus on a whole lot tonight, is grace. Sometimes we say unmerited favor. Sometimes we talk about it being a gift. That's God's part. That is the part in this combination that I cannot provide. Watch the construction, and I left it where Ephesians 2 verse 8 stayed up there at the top. "For by grace you have been saved," and then we'll pull out for a second that prepositional phrase, "through faith." We'll jump to the end. "And this not of yourselves, it is the gift of God." He starts out on the subject of grace. That is his subject matter in the verse. And so that final phrase goes back to grace. Grace initially has nothing to do with us. Now then, it is a gift. It is extended. We can either accept it or not, so on. But it is God's gift to us. It is God initiated. The fact that he offers salvation at all is a gift. He created us perfect. He created us in a relationship with him. Mankind chose to violate that, to separate ourselves from God, to shatter that relationship. And so at that point, God having already told us that the wages of sin is death, that if we eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we're going to die. God could have said, "That's it. You know, I don't play second chances. I gave you perfection. I gave you the relationship. I gave you life, access to the tree of life." And so, I'm not going to play second chances. The fact that he initiated an offer of salvation at all is a gift. It's unmerited. It's undeserved. We deserved to die. We deserved to be separated. But God said, all right, I'm going to initiate a plan whereby you can be saved. His son on the cross. That's a gift. That's the very definition of a gift. There's nothing I can do to earn Christ's love at Calvary. There's nothing I can do that merits God taking His perfect Son, looking at Him in heaven and saying, I need you to set all of this aside and I need you to go die for them. Forgiveness is a gift. And I want you to think of the magnitude of that gift. The length and the breadth and the depth of God's love for us. That He says, as far as the east is from the west, that's how far I'm going to forgive you. This will no longer be on your account. You accept the salvation on my terms, I'll pay the debt. Nothing I can do to earn it. That's God's part. There's no ledger where God keeps a list of my credits towards salvation. My page with God is either stamped paid in full by the blood of Christ, or my page is in the negative. The good side of my quote ledger, no matter how much good I do, is never going to balance out. I'll always be in the negative if it's not paid in full by the Son of God. So that's grace. That's God's part. But the key thought for us tonight is that phrase that I pulled out a second ago. We're right in the middle of this sentence. God says, oh, by the way, here's your part. By grace you're saved through faith. Grace is extended by God, but it is accepted by me. Just like in the garden, I still have the choice. Do I want it or not? Am I going to unwrap the gift and make the most of it, or am I going to turn it away? Or am I going to unwrap it, but not accept it on God's terms? Those two things together, Paul says, combined to create salvation. God's already taken care of His part, so we're going to focus for a few minutes on our part. That faith part. And I want you to understand up front that there are multiple components to faith. We're not going to deal with all of them in depth. We're going to deal with one of them. But part of it is belief. Part of it is just accepting God at His word. Acceptance of what God has said, what God has done, what God has planned as realities. It is the belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. It is the belief that God does sit on the throne, that there is a heaven and that there is a hell, and so on. It's a mental thing based on the evidence. And that's part of the idea there in the beginning of Hebrews chapter 11. Part of faith is the acceptance of a body of doctrine, sometimes simply called faith, put into place by God, that faith once and for all delivered to the saints. God didn't deliver to us a belief in His Son. We have to do that part, but He delivered to us a body of faith that we have to accept and act upon. It is also, and this is the destination for tonight, and you can go ahead and go back to James chapter 2, because we're fishing a roost there. Faith is an active participation in my salvation. In fact, at the beginning of verse 14, and I've told you this before, I'm not a big writer in the margins of my Bible because of the distraction it causes when I'm trying to read up here. But what you will find in James chapter 2, verse 14, is inward belief plus faithful action equals biblical faith. In other words, there's more to it than just belief. There is work involved. Faith is visible. I may reference it again later, but remember the story of the four men who bring their friend on a pallet to Jesus, and Jesus saw their faith. They didn't say anything. You think of the sinful woman that came to anoint Jesus' feet. Her faith saved her, and she never said a word. And so faith at some point and at some times becomes something that I can see in your life and you can see in mine. It's active. Philippians 2, verse 12. My beloved, as you've always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Now, it has nothing to do with making up my own plan, but he said, you got to do your part. You got to put in the time. You got to make the effort. I may come back to this, I may not, but lodge it in your memory now. I want you to understand that God has his part. That's grace. And so as we look at James chapter 2, I cannot in any way earn my salvation through my works. But I can lose my salvation by my lack of works. So let's go there. James chapter 2, verse 14. What is it, my brethren? What use is, if a man says he has faith but he has no works, can that faith save him? James starts with, when he opens this subject, with what must have been a problem with his audience. There's some reason he's addressing this. There's some reason he's going to spend half a chapter talking about this one thing. What use is it, my brethren, if a man says he has faith but he has no works? So either by the way they're living, they're presenting that argument. They must have thought that was enough. They may be living by that mantra. They may be teaching it. Whatever reason, James addresses it. All right, what use is it? What is the point of you having a belief system if you're not going to work? Then he asks a second question. Is it a saving faith? Everything else that's about to take place between that and the end of the chapter is James dealing with this opening. Dealing with the question, what is the use? Can it save? And he begins to answer his own question or answer their lifestyle. And he does it practically, doctrinally. He's going to do it by example. More than one example. So verses 15 and 16. If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food. And so if you know someone who does not have enough, whatever the case is, some type of physical need is not being met. And one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled. All right, so play it out in your mind. This is a practical question that James is dealing with. You have someone who needs something. It could be clothing, you could be food, and your response to that individual is good luck with that. You're going to leave here naked because I'm not giving you any clothes, but I hope you're warm enough. You're going to leave here hungry because I'm not going to feed you, but I hope you're filled. So, follow James's logic. What use is that? What use is that to the naked one? What use is that to the hungry one? When was the last time you sat down starving half to death and had a meal of words and left the table full? When was the last time you faced, we had 10 degrees not long ago? naked or half naked. And someone said, I hope you can find enough warmth in the world. And you found that it did you any good. James is being very practical. What use is that faith? He says it's none. It didn't do them any good at all. They didn't get full. They didn't get warm. They left in the same condition they came. Whoops. He then shifts to a doctrinal discussion. He's put them flat on the spot now. What use is your faith? He said, now let's take it a step further. Let's go from it being practical to it being doctrinal. Verse 17. Even so, if faith has no works, is dead, being by itself. If faith isn't active, if it didn't feed, if it didn't clothe, if it didn't meet a need, it's dead. It stands alone. One without the other has no value. It's like a biscuit without any gravy. It's kind of lacking any use on my plate, at least. Separate them. Works for the sake of works. Works with no faith when it comes to this spiritual discussion. If the faith is not the motivating factor, my works have no more value in my salvation than the works of those in the world. There are all kinds of good things that get done in our world. But separated from a reason, they have nothing to do with salvation. It's just works. Faith, resting on its own merit, is useless. Faith that's just being tossed out there as a word that's not accomplishing anything, James says, is useless. You're not helping anybody. In other words, he says, it cannot save. He goes back and he answers verse 14. He answers verse 15. He answers the question in verse 16. What is the use? It doesn't have any. It can't save. So he said, now then, let's have an experiment. Someone may well say, James says, look, I know what's going to happen. I'm telling you this and you're going to argue. You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without the works, James says, and here's our experiment. I'll show you my faith by my works. You believe that God is one, you do well. The demons also believe and shudder, but are you willing to recognize, you foolish fellow, that faith without works is useless, it's dead, it has no value. So James says, here, let's try this. I want you to prove your faith to me without doing anything. How do you do it? James says, there's not an answer to that. There's nothing that you're going to be able to do that can prove something that is just a mental thing, an emotional thing with you. And so he turns it around. He says, now then, I want you to watch my works, and you're going to see my faith. I want you to tell me what you see. He said, there's going to be a reason behind the way I act, the things I do, and it's going to be evident to you. You're going to see my faith. Then he uses another illustration, or he uses the first of our illustrations that we're going to look at. He said, the demons believe and shudder. They know who he is. And they believed in what they knew. Remember the story about the suicidal pigs? And Jesus is dealing with that man who's full of demons. And they're saying, please do not cast. We know who you are. We know what you're capable of doing. We're afraid of you. Don't throw us into the abyss. We'd rather go live in those pigs over there. Thing is, it doesn't do them any good. They knew, they believed it, but they were still destined for the abyss, as we were looking at in Revelation 20 this morning. He goes on to say, it is foolish to believe that your faith, disconnected from any work, will save you any more than it's going to save a demon. That kind of faith is useless. He goes to another example, verse 21. Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered up Isaac, his son, on the altar? You see that faith, working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. Now, we've got to reconcile something. Romans says Abraham was justified by faith. Absolutely. But notice, in James, this practical mind of James, notice the exact moment that James is referencing. He's justified by his faith, but now James says, I also want you to understand that he was justified by his works when he offered Isaac. If you go back and you watch the story of Abraham unfold, every promise, every gift, every instance of grace in Abraham's life up until the moment that he sacrifices Isaac is based solely on God. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to give you this child. I'm going to bless the whole world through you. He gets around, he works through this process, and he finally develops a faith that allows him to put Isaac on the altar. And he steps out on that faith, offers Isaac, that's a work, and God says, now I can bless you because of what you've done. Now that is going to be accounted to you as righteousness because I can see your faith. Now you are the friend of God. And so the faith, based on God's grace originally, that went into action at that moment, saved Abraham, made him right before the eyes of God. So he said, let's make a little conclusion right now, and then I'm going to go back and reinforce it. Verse 24. You see that a man is justified by works, not by faith alone. So basically he's asking his readers, does that not make sense to you? Can you not see that and understand it? I don't know why I'm having to explain it to you. You know the story of Abraham. You should be able to see this. God has already revealed to you what real faith is. The whole Old Testament is full of examples of how faith acts. But he goes on, he says, are you missing it? Let me give you a second example. And in the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? Rahab, she knew who the spies were. She believed that God had given them the land. She acted upon it. She becomes added to the genealogy of Christ, Matthew chapter 1. She makes the hall of faith in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 31. And she becomes an example in James's argument that faith and activity cannot be separated. Then he gives the final image, verse 26. The body without the spirit is dead. So also faith without works. When the spirit leaves the body, it's inanimate. It's dead. It's just a body. It's not going to do anything. When works are absent from faith, faith becomes inanimate. Faith becomes just an ideal in our lives that we're claiming and supposedly shooting for, but we're not illustrating. So James's conclusion is faith is active. Already said it, Jesus saw faith in the four friends that brought that man to him. He saw faith in that woman who anointed him. Faith, if you go back to Hebrews chapter 11, is always active. By faith, Cain offered a more excellent sacrifice. Man, I've messed up Cain and Abel all day today. By faith, Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. By faith, Noah built. By faith, Abraham went. And on and on and on. And I'm not talking about showing up for worship. That's part of it. I'm not talking about our contribution. That's part of it. But James is talking about a lifestyle where, to use our very southern phrase, where the rubber meets the road. Where you're walking down the street and there is someone who does not have what you are capable of giving to them. And you are forced to make a decision as to whether or not you're going to act on your faith and give beyond what you've been commanded to do, or you're not. James is talking about something that's going on all the time. He's talking about prayer, and he's talking about study, and he's talking about service, and he's talking about evangelism. My part of salvation, here's the point. Faith is worthless without get up and go. If I'm not going to do anything with it, I might as well not claim it. Some things do not go together. Now again, that is a personal thing. As far as I'm concerned, peanut butter and jelly do not go together. Oil and water do not go together. Most of the time, cats and dogs do not go together. Faith and inactivity, faith and complacency, faith, and let's call it what it is, laziness, do not go together. We are about to embark on a new series of Bible classes where, if we are open and tender-hearted, we are going to be challenged in our faith. Evangelism is not something where God, Ephesians chapter 4, God called some to be apostles and some to be evangelists and some to be teachers and some to be pastors and so on. Evangelism, in the sense that we're talking about, doesn't fall in that group. It's not something that we're gifted. It is something that is supposed to come natural to our faith from the moment we obey the gospel. It's supposed to explode out of us. That's what we were talking about in Romans chapter 1 and Paul's eagerness to share the gospel. And so, to make it very, very specific, to narrow down all of these things that we've talked about faith and put it in a moment in time about what is on the mind of our elders right now is, if my faith doesn't mean enough to me that I'm at least willing to share what I know, what I've been through, what God has done for me, and try to bring somebody to the point that someone else can study with him, if that is not my ability, James, not Otis, James just said that my faith has no value. Because I promise you, with his reasoning, if my faith has no value if I do not clothe somebody, and my faith has no value if I do not feed somebody, my faith has no value if I do not reach somebody spiritually. Because which of those three is the most important? So I beg you to be here for Bible class. I beg you to come with a heart that's already been touched by the gospel. And I beg you to come with a faith that is willing to go to work as we stand and sing.